Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're setting out on a mission, really. We want to explore this educational idea that can genuinely turn the world right around you into, well, a classroom, a really dynamic one.
Yeah, we're talking about place-based learning.
Exactly. And our aim today is to unpack what that really means and, maybe more importantly, look at some fantastic hands-on projects you can actually do with your learners. Stuff that brings learning alive.
And the key thing I think to get right away is that place-based learning is like fundamentally local.
Local how?
Well, it uses the actual community, the environment right there around the school as the main learning space. It's way more than just, you know, taking a field trip now and then.
Okay.
It's really centered on the learners, driven by their own questions, lots of hands-on experiential stuff, getting involved civically, doing meaningful service. It's learning by doing right where you live.
Okay, I get that. But say the curriculum topic is, I don't know, American history or maybe ecology. It can be taught anywhere, right?
Right.
So how does doing it locally make the learning unique?
That's the magic of it, really. So while the core knowledge, the concepts might be universal, the actual work the students produce, that's always unique.
Because
it directly reflects their local community, its specific history, its environment, its people. It just grounds the learning in a way that makes it, well, incredibly meaningful. It connects straight to the world they actually see and live in every day.
Right. It makes it relevant.
Okay.
Okay. I see. So let's make this concrete. What does this actually look like? Can we dive into some of those real world examples you mentioned?
Absolutely. Let's start with one that taps into history. Imagine your learners becoming like digital curators.
Okay.
Their task, to build an online museum all about the unique history and influences of your community. You know, how it started, how it grew, the people, the key places, artifacts. But it's not just facts and dates.
It's the stories behind them.
Exactly. It's really about capturing the human stories.
That sounds way more engaging than a textbook chapter. How would you even kick something like that off? How do you get students interested?
Well, a really nice way to start, I think, is maybe having learners bring in something historical from home. You know, like maybe their grandparents' old rolling pin or some old baseball cards, something like that.
Ah, to show how objects tell stories.
Precisely. It sparks that discussion. Then you could look at some existing online museums together, like the Anne Frank House has amazing digital stuff just to see how they connect people to artifacts virtually.
Yeah.
And instead of just, you know, lecturing, you ask them, what do you already know about, say, famous local people or big events? Maybe show some old photos to jog their memory. It immediately flips the dynamic, you see. They're not just receiving info, they're starting to search for it.
Right. Okay, so they've got some initial ideas. How do they become these historical detectives you mentioned to find the deeper stories, stuff beyond what they already know?
Yeah, this is where the real inquiry kicks in. So instead of just hitting the library or Wikipedia first, they brainstorm. Where else could we find information?
Like talking to people.
Exactly. Local experts, maybe folks at the historical society, community centers, even interviewing older family members or neighbors about what they remember. It's not just about finding facts. It teaches them how to, you know, evaluate sources, figure out what's reliable, and piece together a narrative from different bits of information. They start seeing history as this living story, not just static facts.
I love that. It makes history feel much more alive. And yeah, a good museum isn't just a pile of objects. It's the stories that connect them. So how do they actually craft that narrative from their research?
So they'd identify maybe the central characters or the key conflicts in the stories they found, and they could create something like a flowchart storyboard.
Okay.
That outlines, you know, the progression of artifacts and the media they'll need to support the story. That might be original photos they take of objects or places, people. Maybe audio clips from interviews, even, I don't know, relevant music. And crucially, this is where they learn about things like copyright and getting permissions. The focus really shifts to creating original content based on their research. It builds empathy, too, understanding the human experiences that shaped their town.
Okay, so they've got the stories, the artifacts, the original media. How do they actually build the virtual museum and get it out there?
Right, so they write the text, you know, the descriptions, the narration, captions for each stop in their online museum. There are lots of online tools they can use to actually build these virtual exhibitions. The goal is something that's engaging and pretty much runs itself.
And then share it.
Yeah. The museum's URL can be shared widely. You could even have the students act as docents, you know, guide community members, maybe city council folks or people from the Historical Society through their museum online. Imagine the pride they'd feel actually contributing to their community's story like that.
That is powerful. Really powerful. Okay, what's another example?
All right, let's shift focus a bit. How about celebrating community heroes? Everyday heroes.
Oh, I like the sound of that.
Yeah, so here the focus is on the kind of unsung champions in the community. Learners identify a real-world hero, not someone in a cape, obviously, but maybe someone campaigning for environmental causes or just helping neighbors with everyday things.
Your quiet heroes.
Exactly. And then they research or ideally interview this person to create media posters, flyers, maybe a little website or slideshow that celebrates what they do.
How do you start that conversation? What even is a hero? It can be a tricky concept.
It can. So a good starting point is a discussion, maybe even using something like a Venn diagram, to distinguish between, say, idols and heroes. What's the difference?
Interesting distinction.
Yeah, and you could use engaging stories or books like Kamala Harris wrote one called Heroes Are Everywhere, just to get them thinking about what truly makes someone heroic. It challenges those surface level ideas about fame and helps them see leadership and positive action in all sorts of places.
Okay. So they've maybe thought about what heroism means. They've identified someone local. What's the research part look like for this? How do they really understand the person's impact?
Well, they'd start by brainstorming what they already know, maybe just based on observation. Then they craft really specific questions for their research or for interviews. And actually, we often encourage doing multiple short interviews.
Oh, why is that?
It lets them refine their questions as they learn more. It's less pressure, too. Key things they have to figure out are, what are this person's key characteristics? What specific actions earned them this hero label in the student's eyes? What do they continue to do? And importantly, what experiences maybe shaped them into who they are? It really helps them grasp how individual actions, often small, consistent ones, add up to something significant.
Gotcha. And then the creative part, turning that research into a celebration.
Right. So they take all that information and weave it into a compelling narrative.
Right.
Then they decide the best way to showcase their hero. Is it a poster, a website, a digital presentation?
Lots of options.
Yeah. And they'll select the most powerful bits from their narrative, maybe quotes from the interviews, impactful photos, maybe even original drawings they do, and use that media to guide the visual design. It teaches them persuasive communication, you know, how to take information and make it accessible and really impactful.
And the potential impact of that project.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, you could display these around the school, sure, but imagine seeing them in a local coffee shop or maybe even City Hall displaying a community heroes collection created by students.
Exactly. Or maybe a tech-savvy group creates a little interactive kiosk display for the community center. And if the heroes are related to a specific subject, like maybe local biologists,
you could connect with a local university or something.
Precisely. Get an audience from a relevant field. It just adds another layer of that real-world connection and impact.
That's fantastic. Okay, let's switch gears again. What about the built environment? Cities, towns.
Good segue. Let's talk about designing a pop-up plaza proposal. This one introduces a concept called tactical urbanism.
Tactical urbanism. Sounds cool. What is it?
It's basically using low-cost, short-term projects to make positive changes in public spaces. Think like temporary little parks, parklets, or maybe just adding some outdoor seating where there wasn't any. Quick, easy interventions.
Okay, I think I've seen things like that.
Yeah. So the project is for learners to identify an unused or underused local spot, maybe near school, maybe in their neighborhood, and design a proposal to transform it into a temporary pop-up space, somewhere for people to relax, maybe reflect, connect.
That sounds really hands-on and
yeah.
Super relevant. How do you get students thinking like urban planners? How do they start understanding what makes a good public space?
Well, you can start just by talking about their own experiences. Have they seen pop-up shops, eaten at outdoor dining setups? What was that like?
Yeah, get them thinking about it.
And get them out there.
Yeah.
Exploring local parks, plazas, taking photos or videos, and really thinking critically. What makes you want to go into this space in the first place? What makes you want to stay for a while? What would make you come back?
Asking the right questions.
Exactly. And there's a great TED Talk by Amanda Burden called How Public Spaces Make Cities Work. Watching that can really spark ideas and introduce them to human-centered design principles. It helps them see their environment not as fixed, but as something they can actually influence and shape.
That's a powerful shift in perspective. Okay, so they've got the basic idea. What are the practical steps? How do they actually design one of these pop-up plazas?
Okay, so first they got to find the space. They use maps, maybe just walk the neighborhood, and they collect data, perimeter area, what's already there, like trees or benches.
Okay, mapping it out.
Then, and this is crucial, they have to interview people who live or work nearby, stakeholders,
Why is that so important?
to understand what the community actually needs or wants in that space. You can't just impose a design, right? It ensures the final idea is actually useful, maybe even loved. They ask things like, is it safe for kids? Do older residents need seating? Is lighting an issue? This whole stakeholder engagement piece is a huge insight into how real-world planning works.
Absolutely. So, research done, community input gathered, then the design proposal itself. What goes into that?
Right, so they brainstorm ideas, always keeping an eye on, cost and feasibility. These are meant to be low-cost projects. They'd create drawings or models, maybe area models showing where features go, make lists of materials needed, and estimate costs, and write up a formal proposal.
Wow, quite detailed.
Yeah, it explains why they chose that location, how their design meets the needs they identified, and what the projected costs are. It's like a mini business plan for improving a public space.
That is comprehensive. And then I guess the big moment pitching the idea.
Exactly. Before they go to like actual city officials, they practice. They pitch their proposals to each other in the classroom, critical friends giving feedback.
Good practice.
Yeah. But the ultimate goal, presenting to real local government agencies, maybe the city council or neighborhood associations, they'd bring their visuals, maps, maybe even little prototypes. Can you imagine the pride if one of their designs actually got funded and built, even temporarily?
That would be incredible. Talk about making a real difference. It shows them the power of these small changes, doesn't it?
Totally. It demonstrates how small-scale interventions can actually lead to bigger positive shifts in their own community.
Amazing. Okay, let's pivot one more time. What about the natural world right around us?
Yes. Let's talk about developing neighborhood field guides. Fantastic field guides.
Ooh, I like that name.
Me too. So here, learners basically become junior biologists. They explore the local plants and animals, maybe just in the schoolyard or a nearby park, and design their own field guide specific to their backyard habitat.
How do you get that started?
Yeah.
Spark that curiosity about local nature.
You can introduce some really unique local species they might not know about, or maybe invite a park ranger or even a knowledgeable parent into the classroom.
Bring in an expert.
Yeah. And then definitely take a nature walk around the school, through the neighborhood, a local park. Use phones or tablets to take photos, maybe sketch, take notes on what they see. For younger kids, just a simple I see, I wonder framework works great to guide their observations. It really deepens that connection to the nature that's immediately around them.
Observation skills seem critical here, right? Like
Yeah.
telling similar species apart.
Absolutely key. You emphasize taking detailed notes. Color, shape, texture, where exactly they found it, because that's crucial for identifying things later. You can even discuss examples of lookalikes, like, monarch and viceroy butterflies.
Mimicry and stuff.
Exactly. It deepens their understanding of adaptations. So they develop those precise observation skills. Then, for the research part, each learner maybe picks one specific local species. They dig in, making sure they answer key questions. What does it look like? What does it eat? Where does it live around here? What does it do? And importantly, specific tips on finding and identifying that species right where you live.
So it's super practical for their location. They're really building a deep understanding. How do they pull it all together into an actual guide?
Well, we encourage them to create their own images, kind of like John James Audubon did.
Oh, wow, like scientific illustration.
Yeah, maybe using digital drawing tools or even hand-drawn sketches they capture with the camera. It blends that scientific accuracy with artistic expression.
Nice. And sharing it.
Imagine printing and vining their collective guides. Make copies for the classroom, the school library, or share the digital version online. They could even give a printed copy to the local nature center or park rangers. Or maybe act as junior rangers themselves and lead a nature walk for a younger class using their guide. It really builds that sense of ecological stewardship, that responsibility for their own patch of nature.
I love that progression. Okay, one last one.
Let's do it. Designing a garden for a local audience. How does your garden grow?
Okay, landscape designers now.
Sort of. Learners design a functional and beautiful garden, but it's tailored for a specific audience or purpose. Maybe for someone trying to save water, or someone wanting to grow their own food in a small space, or just someone wanting to green up their apartment balcony.
So it solves a specific problem.
Exactly. And it involves creating scale models, estimating costs, and even writing care guides.
How do you connect this to bigger ideas?
You can start by discussing current environmental issues. Water conservation is huge in many places. Organic gardening, biodiversity. Get them thinking about gardens in unusual spots, like tomatoes on a porch, a pot of cilantro on a windowsill, or different types of gardens, like xeriscapes that use very little water, or maybe restoring a patch with native prairie plants.
Broadening the definition of garden.
Right. And you can even bring in fascinating historical stuff, like the Three Sisters companion planting method from Native American agriculture.
Corn, beans, and squash together.
Yeah, they grow symbiotically, helping each other out. It connects their design challenge to ancient wisdom and modern environmental needs.
That's a really rich starting point. So how
Yes.
do they actually design the garden?
Okay, they usually work in teams, and the first crucial step is focusing on the type of person they're designing for. That defines the problem and helps narrow down the project. What are the constraints? Maybe it has to fit in a specific size planter, for example.
Designing for a user. Makes sense.
Then they research plants, soil types, nutrients, watering needs, pest control. They might make detailed charts comparing different plants' pros, cons, size, water, sun needs. Then they arrange the chosen plants into a scale design or model. They have to think about accessibility, how it looks, and maybe even companion planting, like the Three Sisters idea. It pulls together science, design, math, even economics.
It's very interdisciplinary,
Yeah.
and it shows how sustainable practices can tackle real issues like food security or local biodiversity.
Right, in their community, yeah.
So what's the final showcase for these budding garden designers?
Often it culminates in a garden fair. The teams create a general description of their garden concept and really detailed care instructions, almost like they're selling it. Oh, cool.
Imagine them setting up booths, maybe at school, showcasing their designs. They could even partner with a local nursery, present their ideas to actual customers, maybe even have nursery staff help evaluate the designs. It's such a great real-world test for their ideas, getting feedback from potential users.
That sounds fantastic. Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground. Virtual museums, community heroes, pop-up plazas, field guides, gardens. If you take a step back, what's the connecting thread here? What makes all these examples place-based learning?
Well, the common thread, as you've probably picked up, is that every single one of these deep dives, whether it's history or urban planning or biology, is deeply, fundamentally rooted in the local environment, their town, their neighborhood, their schoolyard. And that makes the learning immediately relevant. It makes it personal because they're engaging directly with their world, the one they live in.
And it's clearly not just about memorizing facts from a book, is it? These projects seem to demand so much more.
Oh, absolutely not. It's all about hands-on research, thinking critically, solving problems creatively, working together, communicating persuasively. These are essential skills that, frankly, go way beyond any single subject. It really empowers learners. They stop being just passive receivers of information and become active participants, active contributors in their own communities. It transforms the whole learning experience.
It really does seem to transform abstract ideas into something tangible, something real, letting learners actually make a difference right where they are. From uncovering local history to literally reshaping a public space, the possibilities feel kind of boundless.
They really are.
So, maybe a final thought for everyone listening. As you go about your day-to-day, just think about your own neighborhood, your own community. What local story is just sitting there waiting for you or your learners to uncover? Or what local space is maybe just waiting for you to imagine how it could be transformed